You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today, we are in Mur de Bretagne.
Hello there, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Francois Thomazeau.
Hello there.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel. Where are we, Lionel?
We're outside our hotel in beautiful Brittany. We've come a little way away from Mur de Bretagne, where the stage finished, and we're, well, the restaurant at our hotel appears to be a rotisserie, so I'm anticipating that our chicken dinner is rotating round in front of a hot surface as we speak, and I can smell roast chicken.
Yeah, before we get on to dinner, we have quite an exciting stage to discuss. A lot happened today.
That's an understatement, Rich. I think it was gripping, really, from 100 kilometres to go. It was all action, both at the front and in the middle and at the back.
Well, tell us what happened then, Lionel.
Well, I'll try. There was so much that happened on stage six from Brest to Mur de Bretagne, 181 kilometres. The break was, well, the usual suspects in terms of the teams getting into the break. Two riders from Direct Energy, Fabien Grelier and Damien Gaudin. Cofidis rider Anthony Turgis, Laurent Pichon of Fortuneo Samsic, and Dion Smith of Wanty Group Gobert. They got well up the road and were working very well together. And really the stage kicked off with a few crosswinds. Quickstep were forcing the pace and they forced some splits in the bunch behind, and for a while Nairo Quintana, Jakob Fuglsang and Dan Martin were in the second group, but did all come back together. And but it was nervous old racing on sort of narrow roads, and everyone was anticipating the difficulty of these two ascents of the climb at Mur de Bretagne, the finish. Even the brake split up a few times and came back together again. We saw Jakob Fuglsang have trouble, mechanical trouble or a crash, and his Astana teammates were pacing him back, and they got him back on just before the climb.
The Astana.
You're smiling, Richard.
Yeah, because the Astana team seemed a little bit more attentive after the stage to a roadside incident that required emergency attention. We were driving away from the finish, and there was an emergency involving a car that seemed to have had a puncture with a very attractive young lady standing outside the car, and two Astana cars had stopped to help, which I thought was very noble of them.
And almost all of the staff were assisting or standing around.
Maybe we should single out our friend Serge, because I think it's about time we mentioned Serge. The cycling podcast couldn't survive without Serge. Serge is the team doctor with Astana. He's a French guy of Congolese origin who works in Toulouse. He's a former basketball player, and he actually helped, you know, Richard with his bad hip last year. He's helping Lionel with a bad toe this year. He's helping me with a bad finger too. I mean, we couldn't do anything without Serge. I wanted to pay tribute to Serge here.
Well, anyway, as the race went up the climb the first time, it was Fabien Grelier who was the last man standing from the break. He more or less got to the top, still out in front on his own, but was caught. The peloton behind was the pace was on then. Jack Bauer of Mitchelton Scott then went clear on his own and was away for quite a long time when you consider how fast it was going behind. Geraint Thomas got 2 seconds in the bonus sprint behind Bauer. Again, racing whenever the opportunity presents itself. And then came all the drama. Tom Dumoulin punctured with 5.5 kilometres to go. Very unfortunate timing. Really difficult roads. It was chaos at the back of the peloton. All the cars and the vehicles.
Did he puncture or did he break some spokes? Because he appears to have collided with an HTR rider, perhaps even Romain Bardet. Seems to be the verdict on what happened there.
Television announced it as a puncture, but he certainly changed the wheel, didn't he? But anyway, problem for Dumoulin was, I mean, again, you think, oh, well, the riders have all got radios and earpieces and they'll all know what's going on. But Laurens ten Dam, his teammate, was caught completely unawares. Dumoulin went flying past him on the climb and on a rise, and ten Dam was unable to assist him at all, really. Chad Hager did manage to help, but Dumoulin lost time. There was also a mechanical problem for Romain Bardet, But he got back and then seemed to lose touch in the finale. On the climb, with a kilometre and a half to go, Daniel Oss was leading out, looking to set up Peter Sagan. Julian Alaphilippe was looking very good. Richie Port came to the front with Thomas and Adam Yates. And then just as the 1 kilometre banner, just as they reached the kilometre to go banner, Dan Martin attacked hard and sustained that attack all the way to the line. It was an incredible effort, particularly considering the strength of the riders behind. It was Pierre Latour, Bardet's AG2R teammate, who got closest to Martin, but Martin seemed to have a second kick, as they say, and he held on to win the stage, his second Tour de France stage win in his career. The previous one was 5 years ago in the Pyrenees. So it was Dan Martin ahead of Pierre Latour. Alejandro Valverde was 3 seconds back, and it was a stellar group, that wasn't it? It was pretty much everybody: Alaphilippe, Maika, Yates, Mollema, Sagan, Thomas, Roglic, Port, Greg Van Avermaet, who kept the yellow jersey, Quintana, Nibali, Landa. Chris Froome actually lost 8 seconds. TJ Van Garderen was just ahead of him, lost 6 seconds. Rigoberto Urán lost 11 seconds. And then a little group of riders, Warren Barguil, Bob Jungels, Ilnur Zakarin, lost 12 seconds. Bardet's deficit at the line was 31 seconds and Dumoulin's was 53. And he was also hit with a 20-second penalty. So for drafting too close, or too long rather, behind the Sunweb team car in his attempt to get back on. Overall, Van Avermaet is still in the lead. Thomas has moved up to third place at 3 seconds. Van Garderen swaps places with him and is down in third place at 5 seconds. And really then, well, the rest of the top 10 is riders that, well, perhaps not Alaphilippe and Gilbert, but then it's the GC riders are queuing up behind. No changes in the jerseys. Sagan's still in green. Scoins is still in the polka dots and has actually stretched his lead by a couple of points. And Søren Krogh Andersen of Team Sunweb, although he waited for Dumoulin and conceded time, is still in the white jersey. But now Egan Bernal is only 27 seconds behind. And I think, well, Bernal looks like the hot favourite to win the white jersey.
Beware of Pierre Latour.
As well as Pierre Latour.
Well,
Latour's already 2 minutes back on Bernal. Yeah. But of course, this is crazy talk. I mean, 2 weeks to go, no, all the mountains to come.
Long way.
David Gaudu.
But it was the first day, wasn't it, of drama. Much of it mechanically generated drama, with problems with bikes and just the difficulty of racing on these roads. And if you're in trouble, as Dumoulin and Bardet were, well, Bardet, he didn't seem to have a great deal of assistance. He had to swap bikes, didn't he, with Tony Gallopin?
The problem there was, as you said, I mean, on these roads, with the crowds you had, I mean, you know, the Mur de Bretagne is often called l'Alpe d'Huez of Brittany, and in terms of the crowd, it's almost as crowded, which means that, and the road is probably much more narrow than l'Alpe d'Huez, which means that it's very difficult for the riders to hear anything in their earphones. The cars can't overtake and can't come to their rescue if there's a problem. And Bardet and Dumoulin had that problem at probably the worst possible time. And what happened was that Bardet was left, you know, with a mechanical as well. And instead of waiting for his car, well, which was wise because he lost, you know, less time than Dumoulin did, but it took Tony Gallopin's bike. And let's face it, they don't have exactly the same build. They don't have exactly the same, you know, same size of legs or anything. The pedals are not, you know, tuned the same way. So yeah, so it looked like he was coming back, but as soon as the road went a little bit more up, I mean, there was nothing he could do. I heard comments from the team director Julien Jourdi, who said really that at the moment when Bardet was in trouble, they had told Pierre Latour to attack with 800 meters to go, and they were kind of in two minds. So do we ask Latour to go, or do we ask him to wait? And in the end, it was a very bad day it was a Roman bad day, because in the end, Bardet lost time, and Pierre Latour was only second, you know, I think just a second off Dan Martin. So a bad day for AG2R. A funny thing I found when we reached the final. 2 days ago, I talked to Dmitry Konishev, Katusha, about the problems with Ilnur Zakarin, and in very philosophical, fatalistic fashion, he said, "Well, let's wait till we get to Annecy, and we see that all the leaders will be on an equal foot in terms of problems." And oddly enough, Dumoulin and Bardet were the two leaders who didn't have any problem yet. And Konishev was right. There's always the day when you have a problem, and this is the charm of the first week of the tour.
As is often the way on the Tour de France, the true nature of events kind of comes out in the wash, and this evening we've learned that Romain Bardet and Tom Dumoulin actually came together and collided, and that's what damaged both of their bikes and led to them having to chase back on.
A community around the world, stories and films with the most compelling characters, the world's finest apparel, explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. We're very grateful to them for their support. And they have just published a book, Carte du Tour by Paul Fournel. That's available now. You find it at rafa.cc. An interview with Paul Fournel featured in today's episode of Kilometre Zero, which went out this morning, our morning show, sponsored by Hansgrohe. And you'll find that was episode 4, wasn't it? What's coming tomorrow, Lionel?
Oh, tomorrow is 10 years of Argyle. Looking back 10 years, when the tour actually started in Brest, where we were this morning, and it made its way in a sort of opposite direction to the one we've made. The first 2 or 3 days were through Brittany and then into the Vendée, and it was the first year of the Slipstream team, the Garmin Slipstream team, now EF Education First. And just a kind of an interview with Jonathan Vorters and a few other people about the genesis of that team.
Including Will Frischkorn, who almost won a stage for them early on. He was second on a stage won by Samuel Dumoulin, no relation to Tom, and very different in terms of build. I mentioned the book, Carte du Tour. We have a copy of that to offer to a lucky winner, and we want to set you a challenge. Can you come up with, this was relates to a conversation we had on the podcast last night, can you come up with a nickname for Peter Sagan? There were a few today, actually, but tweet us, email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, Facebook us, however, send us a letter.
Pigeons.
Yeah, whatever. Come up and say it in person. Some people came and said hello today to us at the finish, which was nice. Give us a nickname for Peter Sagan, and we'll choose the best one, and it will win a copy of Paul Fournel's book, Carte du Tour. Now, there are a lot of talking points from today. I mean, one of them was Primoz Roglic, I think, in 10th. He had a bit of a disastrous day. He caught behind in the crosswinds with about 100k's to go when Quickset went to the front and really drilled it. His whole team got to the front, and unusual for them to be caught out in crosswinds, actually. They, you know, going back many decades, that team, which has been Rabobank and Super Convex, they are masters of, you know, crosswind situations. So strange to see them caught out in those conditions today. And Roglic got back on, then he crashed, but he finished 10th on the stage, which was an excellent performance, and I think it suggests that he's in very good condition. But the team that put him in trouble was Quickstep, and they had one of the favourites today in Julian Alaphilippe, who does look like Begbie from Trainspotting. Begbie Alaphilippe. He was fourth in the end, but his team, Quickstep, were very aggressive. A long way out, 100 kilometres to go, and they did cause a lot of damage. Francois, I think you spoke to the big team boss, Patrick Lefebvre, at the finish.
Yes, I did. I mean, I asked him if they were not being too greedy, because they already, you know, won 2 stages, were a number of jerseys. I mean, more obviously to come for them. And well, and he was quite frank about it, you know. Probably, you know, greed comes with hunger, as we say in French, you know. And obviously, they were probably overambitious today, because he said they were actually chasing the stage victory, but also the yellow jersey, which is the reason why they tried to split the peloton early on, to try to, you know, already get rid of a couple of riders, you know, or trap a couple of GC leaders that they could. In the end, for the second day running, it was just a little bit too short. But once again, they can't really complain, can they? So, well, shall we listen to Patrick Lefebvre?
Patrick,
is it a kind of a disappointment today? I mean, you've been doing very, very well since the start of the tour. And for those 2 days when we thought that maybe Quickstep would be even stronger, well, the victory is not that, you know, in the finish line.
Well, we cannot complain. We won already 2 stages and it could have been 4 if we were lucky, but yeah, no problem. Of course, we don't have to lie about it. We hoped it this morning to catch the yellow today, but it didn't happen.
Because I mean, there was some questions, you know, in the press room, and some why do the quick step create a split so early in the stage?
Well, because if we don't do it, I think the breakaway goes to the finish. And for some people, it was maybe okay because then there's no Boney. They're not good enough to win the tour, of course, and to have the yellow for the next days. But we wanted to try to take the stage win and the yellow, and we created a split because some of the GC guys were not concentrated, for sure. But the crosswind was not long enough to make more damage.
But haven't you worked a little bit too hard, Quickstep, since the start of the tour? You're kind of the only team that has been working so far.
Maybe we have to take some rest tomorrow and the day after.
Well, the winner today, Dan Martin, is a rider you know well. I suppose you're not surprised by his victory.
No, we know that Dan is in this kind of uphill finish is very strong. I think last year or 2 years ago, I don't remember, was even also second after Sagan. In an uphill finish, even if he's quite skinny, he's quite explosive, and he did a big number today. But don't forget, there was a headwind, and this young guy Latour came on 10 meters and could not catch him.
What's left for Quickstep to look for in this tour?
Try to win tomorrow or the day after with Gaviria, and hope to catch the yellow one day.
Yeah, Quickstep would have been among the favourites for today's stage, with Alaphilippe and Philippe Gilbert, of course. Alejandro Valverde, another rider who that climb did suit. It was his kind of ideal territory. But this morning, a few people I spoke to, including Brian Holm of Quickstep, tipped Dan Martin. And so, you know, it was obvious, really, that those kind of riders were going to... we're going to prosper on that climb.
I know what's coming.
Just a little callback to yesterday's podcast where I asked the world's stupidest question ever, whether the Mur de Bretagne bore any resemblance to the Mur de Huy, and Dan Martin was kind of dismissive, but not in a bad way. Well, this morning we got a message from our friend and colleague, JP from Het Nieuwsblad.
Jan-Peter de Vlieger.
Yeah, who helped us on one of our Friends of the Podcast specials recently about Johan de Moink and the 1978 Giro. Anyway, he said, in Het Nieuwsblad today, Serge Pauwels, and I quote, Mur de Bretagne is a lot like Mur de Huy. And Jan Bakkerlandt says, you can compare the Mur de Bretagne to the Mur de Huy, especially the first part. So maybe not the most stupid question ever. Dan Martin, of course, has been in the top four at Flèche Wallonne 4 times, runner-up twice. He was runner-up on the Mur de Bretagne when the Tour was last year behind Alexis Vuillemoz. And today, if you said the optimum place to attack is 1 kilometre from the line, I would have thought that's too far out. But he looks strong.
This is where it's very different to the Mur de Huy, isn't it? Because the Mur de Huy tends to favour people who go as late as possible, whereas... Mur de Bretagne is kind of a climb of two halves, and the first half is a bit steeper. And so we saw Alaphilippe and then Dan Martin, the Mur de Huy specialist, go a little bit earlier, I think, than we would certainly see them on the Mur de Huy.
Yeah, I talked to a couple of riders, to Alexis Vuillemoz this morning, and to Reinhardt, to Jan Sevet van Rensburg, who actually, well, it might sound a little bit strange to talk to him, but he won on the Mur de Bretagne 6 years ago on the Tour de Bretagne, and they all said the same thing. They said it's a strange combination because you have to go full gas and still keep a little bit of strength for the final sprint. But they were all saying that the second half is a little bit, you know, less tiring. William was attacked from very far and when he won the stage the last time he went on Mur de Bretagne. I can't remember exactly. I think Kendall Evans, there were more of a fight to the finish. But obviously, Dan Martin was second to Vuillemoz when that happened. He probably learned a lesson from that, and he probably learned that the best way probably to win on Mulderbottein is to attack from rather far.
Even with that headwind, which when we were stood on there, we weren't actually on there, but it was windy all day today, wasn't it? And the reports were that it was a headwind. But I guess once you get your nose in front, the challenge is, well, coming out of the slipstream and then feeling the wind in your face, you know, Dan Martin took it on from the front and was just incredibly strong, I thought.
I think an excellent ride from Dan Martin. Probably the best result that team has had, and a result they needed. It's interesting because he's sort of transforming himself a little bit into a GC rider rather than a stage grabber. Certainly that was the impression last year at the Tour de France. Terrible team time trial left him with quite a lot to do, but he's up to 21st overall, and just the win today, I think, will have given him a lot of confidence and shown that he's in really good form, because it was a good test, and we saw, I think the likes of Landa, Richie Porte, Rafał Majka, Valverde, you know, they were all up there, and even, you know, Froome just losing that few seconds, it's just he wouldn't. If Chris Froome, I don't think in any of the years he's won the Tour, I don't think he'd have lost 5 seconds on a finish like that.
No, I mean, I think you gain small clues from a day like today, don't you? That, you know, who's in good shape. It's a climb like that, so much about positioning, but of course positioning is easier if you feel good and if you're going well. So it was a bit of a surprise to see Froome lose time, even though it's only a few seconds. On the flip side, Geraint Thomas is riding extremely well, and again, it's the first week of the Tour. You always have to pay attention to riders who seem to be getting round seamlessly without problems. It always near the front, at the front. He hasn't crashed, which, you know, you can't say that about Thomas every year. Still the cobble stage to come, which, you know, he is good on the cobbles, even though he's had falls there in the past. So you're looking at the GC, there's just those little clues, and maybe in sort of when we get to the Alps and we see the first proper climbing of the Tour, we'll look back and reflect and say, the signs were maybe there on the Mur de Bretagne, so-and-so wasn't so good, or so-and-so was looking good.
Well, the leaders didn't have any problem whatsoever since the start of this Tour. There aren't many left, actually. They all had the crashes, mechanicals, punctures, and I think today, as you say, that what struck me, actually, because we said it before the Tour, but it's kind of a journalistic habit to pick as many favorites as you can to make the race look more exciting than it sometimes is. But when you look at the result today, I mean, there are really 15 guys that could feature, that could be on the Tour podium in Paris. And it's very difficult to tell who they are. I mean, who the top three will be in more than two weeks time in Paris.
Well, we're in Brittany, so obviously there's some farm traffic driving past us there. That's some kind of tractor and
that's taking some the French flavour of the day.
Yeah. You know,
chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, reminding us to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by Gusto. Richard, before the Tour de France, we received our Gusto boxes. What was in yours?
Gusto, you said that with great gusto, Lionel. Well, I'm actually a long-time customer of Gusto. We get a box delivered quite regularly with the ingredients for three meals for two, and the ingredients come in just the right amounts that you need with recipe cards. And I must say, for someone who's not really a dab hand in the kitchen, they make me feel like quite a competent chef at times.
Amazing. Well, it was my first experience of the Gusto box the week before the Tour, and it was absolutely perfect timing, really, because I was up against it. As you can imagine, I was pretty disorganized in the few days before we came away here. So having the 10 to table range of recipes was really helpful. The recipe I enjoyed most was the black bean chili, which even accounting for my fairly rudimentary skills, I managed to serve that up in around about 11 and a half minutes, which I thought was pretty impressive. All the ingredients are in the right quantities. There's no waste. You don't suddenly realise, oh, I haven't got any of this or I haven't got any of that. So once I'd served it up, you know, it was packed with flavour as well. I was really quite taken by the whole experience.
I understand, Lionel, that your partner was concerned about this, that they're about about the quantities. The quantities might not be sufficient.
She
a very telling concern that.
Yeah, she. Thanks for revealing that, Richard. Yeah, she was concerned that the portion sizes wouldn't be big enough for me, but but I can confirm that the portion sizes were absolutely spot on. I just eat a normal amount, Richard. Honestly. Anyway, for a limited time, Gusto are offering a whopping 50% off your first and second recipe box of three or more meals with the code Cycling. Go to gusto.co.uk/cycling to claim this offer now. Or simply enter the code Cycling at checkout once you've chosen your recipes. Gusto is G-O-U-S-T-O. So GOUSTO.co.UK/cycling.
The bells are ringing here. And, I mean, the two people we haven't really spoken about too much, but were in the news for the wrong reasons, like Dumoulin Bardet. I mean, as you said, Dumoulin Bardet were two of those leaders who've not until now put a foot wrong, and you'd have to go through, well, Mika Landa perhaps, although a poor team time trial for Movistar, but there aren't many who are still kind of, well, Geraint Thomas is
well, Rafał Majka as Rafał well on the sort of long list has had a, and Valverde as well, worryingly kind of quiet.
Yeah, but again,
for
the Movistar team didn't perform that well in the team title. I mean, there's no obvious kind of, you know, big favourite riding around on a cushion of air, as a local Breton Jean Bobet once said of Fausto Coppi. But Bardet and Dumoulin today, I mean, Dumoulin, that's a real hammer blow, not only losing the time that he lost on the stage, but then being deducted another 20 seconds for sitting behind the car for too long. It was very tricky, and what do you do in that situation? The race is splitting up ahead of you. There's a sort of barrage, perhaps, in effect, because riders are being dropped. The team vehicles are being held behind those drop riders. Mm-hmm. And so there's not as much assistance as there would normally be.
Ironically, it could have been worse, because let's imagine Michael Matthews was still in the race and all these teammates helping him win the stage, and Dumoulin is left at the back like Bardet was. I mean, it could have been even worse. Because
but Grand Tours these days, including the Grand Tour that Dumoulin won, are often won by seconds, by less than a minute. And so today he's lost more than a minute.
No one from Team Sunweb, when we got to the bus, was talking. Sports director Luke Roberts got in the bus and was talking to the riders and didn't come out. The door just closed and they quietly drove away. What do you think of the chances that Sunweb might appeal that penalty? And what do you think of the chances of it being overturned?
Because I don't know, Lion, I'm not a UCI commissar. I don't know, but you would think they would, because it's quite harsh. But it was
blatant, though, wasn't it? I mean, he was right on the middle of the bumper for a long period of time. But we see that day in, day out, and it is a subjective judgment by the commissaire, because if you do that in the first
he's coming
half
back
of the stage,
a misfortune, not after being dropped, and I think that's always a crucial difference. You know, when you're coming back after a puncture or a crash or any other mechanical, I think there should be some discretion applied to these.
It's funny, because Thomas Voeckler was on the bike of, you know, France Télévision, and he was actually talking about that and saying that usually when a mechanical or a puncture takes place on a wide road, very, you know, speed, you know, fast road, national road or anything, the commissaires, you know, tended to be rather harsh, and when things happen on a small road, they tend to be a little bit, you know, more lenient. And let's be fair. I mean, the road when Dumoulin had his mechanical was very narrow. The cars couldn't come, you know, to him easily. I mean, is it safe for the rider to stop and to try and cross to the right with all the teams and riders coming behind? I mean, my impression was he stayed where he was and waited for the car to come. So there's obviously probably ground to appeal. You know, the rules are the rules.
they are, Francois. But again, you know, this is the nature of these early days in the Tour, when the roads are today's stage looked beautiful, spectacular, great roads for racing on. I mean, the you know, Richard, you've often made this point about the Tour looking its most dramatic when it really is squeezed into the roads that they're racing on. You just see the peloton like water finding the line of least resistance, and on these country roads, the Tour looks brilliant, beautiful, and distinct from a lot of the rest of France here in Brittany. I mean, watching them just come over the climb at Mur de Bretagne, it doesn't look like anywhere else in France, really. And as a sort of televisual spectacle, today was full on and dramatic. But there are casualties in terms of the race. I mean, Dumoulin won, Bardet another. That's what the opening week of the race is always like. But it's funny when we get into the mountains and if Dumoulin loses some time there or gains some time there, this will almost be discounted as well. You know, it's almost like the time that is gained and lost in these stages is sort of a race-generated handicapping system before we get to the mountains.
You know, it's a classic of the Tour. I mean, when we get close to Paris or, you know, in the Pyrenees, we will say, oh, remember, Tom Dumoulin lost 20 seconds on a time penalty. He could have won. We never know this could happen. And going back to your impression of the small roads and the Mur de Bretagne, it was interesting. I go back to what David Gaudu told me yesterday. If you go right in the Mur de Bretagne, there'll be leftovers. I mean, you know, paint on the road and unfortunately maybe a little bit of rubbish. I hope not. But it'll be nothing. It's just a long stretch in the middle of nowhere. And the magic of the Tour is that the Tour turns this kind of stretch, you know, going up nowhere. I mean, it's not a mountain, it's not a hill, there's nothing really at the top, into something magical. Probably the Mur de Huise is exactly the same with the Flèche Wallonne, or sometimes, you know, the mountain passes on the Tour when you go to skiing or you're hanging around on holidays and you go up Col de Vars or whatever. You said, well, this is really what it is, because you don't have the excitement, the crowds, everything, the tension that goes around it. So yeah, the Tour has also that magic impact on the roads themselves.
We are in Brittany, and we do need to have Francois's French flavour for this evening. One of the famous Bretons, of course, Bernardino, was at the start today, and I was reminded of what he said when he stepped down from his role as the podium guy at the Tour. He said, if I come back to the Tour, it will not be as an official with a VIP pass or anything. It will be at the side of the road with my grandson. Well, there he was in the Village de Par this morning.
Not only there, he was
taking advantage of not only that, but
he was wearing a sort of Wembley Market version of the official Tour de France staff uniform of blue shirt and chinos.
Do you think he was meant to give them back, to ASO?
It wasn't official. It wasn't official Tour staff uniform, but it was as close as you could get. Bought on the open market.
My impression was that it just happened to be in Brest today, and say it just come with his grandson to say hi.
Yeah, well, they had the vegetable market this morning. Maybe he was selling some produce to the market.
Can you tell us about this part of the world, Francois?
Well, we started from Brest, and you mentioned that before. I mean, it's a big port. I mean, it's really. Well, there's a saying about Brest that's not very nice for Brest, and which says you only go to Brest if you go to Brest. There is no reason to you don't drive past Brest, or it's really a place. It's the end. It's kind of at the end of the world, and you only go there if you have something to do there.
Next stop, New York, huh?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, mainly. So, one thing I'd like to tell our dear listeners, who are, some of them, I'm sure, are kind of partial to French chanson. There's a great, great song about Brest that's been, it's quite recent, about 10 years ago, written by a girl called Miossec, and it's Miossec, called Brest. It's funny, we all have those kind of songs, the song, or one, a couple of songs that make you cry every time you listen to it. And his song Brest by Miossec really, brings a tear to my eye every time I'm listening to it, because it's a tribute to his dead mother. And it's a great, great song. I mean, if you were into French chanson, and even in general into music, because it's just a great song, listen to Miossec sing Brest. I'm not going to sing it, of course, because otherwise I would cry. But yeah, so this is what we could say about Brest. About Mur de Bretagne, it's funny, Mur de, in excellent Kilometer Zero episode on, by Paul Fournel. He says that there are a number of places in France that only got famous because of the Tour de France. This is the case with Mur de Bretagne. Nobody had heard of Mur de Bretagne before it was on the Tour de France. Well, one guy had heard about it, Corot, you know, a French painter, pre-impressionist. He painted a couple of pictures at the chapel of Mur de Bretagne, but that's about it. There's nothing to say about Mur de Bretagne mainly. But they had this chance to have this long stretch, you know, going up with a fine percentage. And it became famous, actually, in 1947. In the first time it was used on the tour, it was not the finish of the stage. It was in the middle of the stage. And that day, Jean Robic, who won...
The Hobgoblin of the Brittany Moor.
Yeah, Jean Robic, you know, won the tour finally. I mean, you know, attacked and made a name for himself. I think the stage was won by Pierre Brambilla and... A rider very dear to my heart, René Vietto. Well, I should say very dear to my toe. But it would be too long to explain. Those who understand what I just said will understand. René Vietto lost a lot of time the first time he went to Mur de Bretagne. And then, you know, well, we had a couple of finishes, 2011.
2015, yeah.
And this year. And actually, Mur de Bretagne, the main thing to say about Mur de Bretagne is, you know... the tour.
It's a striking road, though, isn't it? And when I've seen it both with no tour apparatus no spectators on it, and it's just a dead straight road that goes up to the top and then over the top and then slightly gentler down the other side, really.
Absolutely.
Just before we kind of move on to talk about something else, we should mention Greg Van Avermaet, really, because he's ridden really well this week. Took the yellow jersey, you know, because of the team time trial. BMC Racing is coming to a head. We think that there may be some kind of announcement. There's been rumours that of a kind of merger with the CCC Polish team. Now, a few people I spoke to this morning said they doubt that's a viable alliance. I was talking to Jonathan Vorters in the Start Village this morning about how difficult it is when your sponsor pulls out mid-season. And I mean, Cannondale found themselves in a worse position than this much later in the year and really through what he described it as a miracle that they managed to keep the team on the road and get an alternative sponsor. BMC Racing, after the death of Andy Rees earlier this year, a couple of things occurred to me. One, that no provision had been made for the team to carry on, you know, maybe some money left to, you know, secure the team for another year. And also the difficulty that basically they're trying to shop around for sponsorship, knowing that Richie Port's going, Greg Van Avermaet's going, and most of the other of their best riders are going.
I was told that Greg Van Avermaet has a clause in his contract that if BMC find a new sponsor, he might stay. But
it's not decided, though, is it? And I mean, no. Greg Van Avermaet, I mean, he's in his, you know, well in his 30s now, but still a very desirable, you know, commodity in cycling. His days in the yellow jersey certainly aren't going to be doing him any harm whatsoever. But I think that they've ridden really well. And we talked about Richie Port being in the same group as Adam Yates and Chris Froome in the crash on the opening day. I know it's only 9 seconds, but, you know, Port has kind of clawed his way up a little bit. And of the riders ahead of him, Fuglsang, Mika, Valverde, Uran, possibly Jungels, possibly Van Garder and possibly Thomas. Yeah, he's back in a really good position, Richie Port.
The problem with Richie Port, I mean, I've said many times before, I mean, probably on the same podcast as well, that, you know, seeing his first week very often on the tour, you think that's it. That's the year. He's going to do it. He feels, you know, you can tell he's confident. He has the legs. I mean, everything's there. He looks confident. He's smiling and everything. And something happens. Well, hopefully for him, nothing will happen to him.
But the big thing about BMC Racing is, what do they do on Sunday? Because Greg Van Avermaet is an absolute hot favourite for the cobbled stage, along with Peter Sagan, a former Paris-Roubaix winner, of course, absolutely at home on the cobbles, but he has Richie Port. What will they do? It's going to be fascinating to see how they play that, and we'll talk about the cobbles in the next part.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Beta Fuel, the new superfuel from Science in Sport, is a 2-to-1 maltodextrin to fructose isotonic drink that delivers 80 grams of carbohydrates per serving without upsetting your stomach. This formulation means your stomach can process more carbohydrates per hour than glucose alone would allow. And this could make all the difference to your ride, whether you're cresting the Alpe d'Huez or just crossing the line at your local Sportive. Available on scienceinsport.com from July the 12th.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products with the code SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. We just heard a message there about Beta Fuel. Now, Science in Sport have launched a bit of a competition. They're a challenge. They're asking people to post and tag a picture of themselves and or a friend or somebody that you know who doesn't mind, generally looking knackered during or after a training session.
Did it have to be after cycling?
With the,
could it be after a hard day on the tour?
Get onto that in a moment, Lionel. The sort of subject is never bonk again, and we've all been there, haven't we? I was talking about this today, was I not? Or yesterday? The time when I went on a bike ride with my brother in Aberdeen, we were both at university there, and it was a winter's day, and it was cold, and we went without any money. There were no mobile phones in those days. this was the last millennium. And we did a long, long ride, and I think after about 70 miles, both of us blew a gasket, and we had no money, and went into a shop, and we actually swapped our watches for lots of chocolate bars, and I had to ride back out the following week to pay money and get our watches back.
Oh, wow. 10 years ago, I did the Paris-Roubaix Sportive, the full distance, 265 kilometres, and if I knew then, I mean, I'm not an expert, but if I'd had any wits about me when it came to fueling, I'd have not suffered as much in the last hour or 2 hours of that ride, because once you've run out of energy, that's it. There's no way you can play catch up. And I think with the technology that's going into researching, you know, how the body absorbs fuel,
Beta Fuel, Lionel, that's what we need.
Well,
in case we need Buffy one day.
Again, you know, I'm the sort of person I'd need to be told, okay, here's your X number of gels, and have them every 20 minutes or whatever the strategy is. And you know, I'm definitely the sort of person that would benefit from that kind of thing, because you know me, Rich, I don't like to be hungry. Once I've run out of fuel, I can't function.
If we do miss a Buffy one day, I will be taking a picture of you and posting on social media, Facebook and Twitter, copying in Science and Sport with the words never bonk again, hashtag Beta Fuel.
We nearly bonked three or four nights ago when we stopped at a pizza machine, you know, instead of having dinner in a great place.
We ended up in a wonderful place, didn't we?
We did, yeah. But the bonk was not far. You know?
We need to tell this story in Friends of the Podcast Only
Victory
road
from
trip.
The jaws of defeat. We're not going to talk about the football last night.
No. No one mentioned the football.
Wanted to mention it once.
That's cruel. That's like poking a bear with a stick.
You're over it now, though.
I'm over it now. Oh, the pizza machine, though. Before we finish this tour, I want to sample the roadside pizza shed and see what the pizzas are like. But anyway.
Cobbles. We're starting to look ahead. We've got a couple of sort of sprinty stages ahead of us, but we're starting to look ahead to Sunday and the cobbles. And I think we've been looking forward to this stage for a long time, but particularly when Matt White came over to London before Christmas in November, and he sort of underline just how serious a cobbled stage it is.
Yeah.
It's not just a few token stretches of cobbles, is it? It's a proper cobbled stage.
No, it's 15 sections of cobbles, a lot of them very difficult. It's not full-on Paris-Roubaix, but it's probably 75% Paris-Roubaix and condensed into a short period of time in the stage. When he came to London for our live event, Matt White, he was unequivocal. He said that it was too much for the tour. And a couple of mornings ago, I went to ask him whether he still held the same opinion. Matt, back in the winter, you were pretty down on the difficulty of the cobbled stage, saying it was a bit too much. Now we're only a few days away. What do you think?
Nothing's changed. I'm not a big fan of people crashing out of races just because of the course. I think cobbles has a place in the calendar, and it's April. I think there's a lot of cobbles here, and it's not one or two sections. It's not easy pavé. It's a mini Paris-Roubaix on stage 9. So look, it is what it is, and we have to adapt to it. And we brought a team to help support Adam as best we can. We've got some great classics riders in the team, but been nervous enough first week, enough crashes, and then you throw that into the end of the first period of the race, and it's a recipe for disaster.
How is Adam on cobbles? Because as a young man, he was racing in the east of France. I think he did a bit of racing in northeastern France and Belgium, so he must have ridden them before.
He has, and he's done 3 recons on the pavé. And for his style, he's a little guy, so but for his style, it actually works quite good. He's more than competent on the pavé. But he's, you know, as one of the little guys, he's obviously, we're about just surviving that stage. And we've got some guys to help him do that.
You must remember 2010, Andy Schleck managed to finish in the front group with Hushovd and Cancellara. Frank Schleck ended up in hospital. That's how it goes, I guess.
Yeah, it does, and no one likes to see that. Yeah. Teams have invested millions of dollars to get ready for this one race, and it could be over with. Look, it can happen any time, but the dynamic certainly changes when you put in 15 sections over 22k of cobbles.
What about people who say, well, the Tour de France has got 105-year history, and a tour without cobbles is actually more unusual than a tour with cobbles if you take the whole history of the race?
Yeah, I think the sport's changed as well. The technology and the bunch is different. There's a different mentality in the bunch. It's a lot more cutthroat than it was even 10 or 15 years ago. The added pressure of media, social media, the information the guys have got with directional changes, with apps, everything else. It's a very nervous, intense environment. And the guys, you talk to the guys. The guys that you've been racing all year, they just turn into different beasts once they pin a Tour de France number on. And that's why we're having so many crashes. No one's backing down.
In terms of the cobbles, there's 15 sections. I mean, is there a number of sections that you would be more happy with? You know, is there a limit that you think, well, yeah, let's have cobbles in the Tour, but up to a certain number of kilometres or a certain number of sections?
No, I think the cobbles they've used in the past, when they put in 2 or 3 sectors, it's caused enough drama, those sections in the past, let alone 15 sectors. So I think, you know, if they want to keep the public entertained with crashes and etc., yeah, put them in every now and then. But I believe they've just gone too far with this one. And look, we might come out the other side with time gaps, but my opinion doesn't change. I'd prefer to see a little bit less cobbles, a little bit more of an even race. I think, like I said, the cobbles have a pace in our calendar, and for me, that's March, April.
Do you think that the Tour, the fact that it's World Cup final day, the fact that the stage finishes just before the kickoff of the match, do you think that there's some kind of commercial kind of drive behind picking such a dramatic, potentially dramatic course?
Yeah, I'm not sure about where they put it. I think any day people will watch it. It'll be probably one of the most spectacular stages of the Tour. But if they want drama, the Frenchies love a bit of drama, and they're going to get it, aren't they?
Lastly, that's entrance into the first section. I mean, it looks like trying to squeeze, as we say, a pint into a quart pot. There's not enough room for the whole peloton to get to the corner first. I mean, it looks like a real bottleneck.
It does. That's 172 riders are not going through that corner. To try to paint a picture, it's a bit of road furniture through town. You get to the top of this rise and you have 1.5 kilometres of dead straight road downhill at about 3 or 4%, turning from 3 lanes into 1 car width. There's a house on the right hand side, bushes on the right hand side, and a field on the left, and it's a very rough entry. And look, half the field will be scared, very very scared, because they're just not used to riding this style of racing. That's the difference between the classics period and now. We've got 15 specialists, maybe another 30 to 40 guys who are very competent, and the other guys are just surviving or getting in the way, or a combination of the two.
What will you do? Will you try to take the race on, or will it be a case of let the carnage happen and stay safe?
Yeah, we're still bantering around a couple of different ideas with how we approach, especially the first sector. One of them is, do we just go to the back and just avoid? Because the worst possible thing for us is Adam to crash there. Our tour, you know, any GC leader, if you crash there, you know, you potentially finish your tour. So it's calculated risk, isn't it? You know, do you go to the back and say, okay, if something happens in front of us, we'll just avoid it. If we have to go off-road, bikes on the shoulder, run around and start it from the back, with a team of six or seven guys. We've got 100K to go. I said it's not Paris-Roubaix. There's 30 or 40 guys who would go on with it, but it's too far. Or do you go, well, let's get in the washing machine there and try to put Adam into the first 10 wheels? But the problem is because it's downhill. If you mistime it, you know, you're going to be caught right where you don't want to be, and that's in potential crash zones. So there are ideas we're bantering around at the moment, and we'll obviously have a plan for Sunday, but we're just concentrating on day-to-day at the moment. But it's there looming, and it's coming closer.
But worst-case scenario, you'd rather lose 3-4 minutes than crash.
Definitely, and I think the strength of our team and the strength of Adam on that stage, I think we're not going to lose that much time unless there is a crash. I'm learning Tour de One's way, but we've got to sell it to the riders, and the riders have got to, that's what they've got to want to do it as well.
Fascinating stuff from Matt White there. Obviously, they've got to protect Adam Yates, who has some experience of cobbly type roads, having raced as an amateur in France and a bit in Belgium. So it's not like he's as green as the grass, and he's got a very strong team around him. But to hear Matt White say they're still weighing up the possible approaches and even considering why not sit at the back in that mad kind of rush to the first section of cobbles, it always reminds me of something Sean Kelly told me about his first Paris-Roubaix and saying that the race to the first section of cobbles were like something out of a scene out of Ben-Hur, just everyone just, you know, bodies going everywhere. And it, of course, in Paris-Roubaix, there's a sense that you can lay everything on the line because it's all about that one day. Whereas in the Tour de France, you know, there's another 2 weeks to go. And teams will be weighing up whether or not it's better to lose 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 2 minutes, whatever, than crash out. Crashing out, of course, means game over. So we're going to see some really interesting strategies, I think,
Movistar
on Sunday.
Going to be interesting as well, yeah. Aren't they? How they approach it. Yeah, Dave Brailsford was saying that the approach to that first section of cobbles gets very, very narrow. So he was anticipating quite a fight.
I had an interesting talk with José Luis Arrieta, who were mentioning Movistar, was saying, in a way, there's no reason to prepare for the cobble stage, because even if you're the best cobbles rider, you can crash or have a puncture, or so, you know, just take it easy. And another point I'd like to make, we'll get back to cobbles, of course, many times in the course of the week, but just being the old man in the team, if you take the 100-something editions of the Tour de France, in about 80 of them, there were cobbles. So cobbles are not an exception. You know, get back to your history books and you'll find out that most Tour de France included cobbles. So it's nothing new or exceptional.
Well, we'll be out on the cobbles, I think, on Sunday for an episode of Kilometre Zero.
Looking forward to that. Before we go tonight, though, I did speak to Servais Canavan.
Oh, yes.
Who had a very different view to Matt White's in terms of whether he thinks the cobbles are good. It's something Francois said as well, that the cobbles were a regular feature of the Tour de France and became less so in the 90s. And Servais Canavan makes that point that he thinks they should be something that features in the Tour every year. He's a former winner of Paris-Roubaix, of course, as a sports director at Team Sky now. So here's what he had to say about the cobbles and about the approach that Team Sky are taking to that stage. You've also got some of your friends and people you know out to help on the cobbles. It's a huge day, of course. What's your kind of approach to that, and how many people are Team Sky likely to have along the stage?
On Sunday we will have average every 600 metres on each section. We will have someone with wheels, and then of course at the end someone with bottles and wheels. Total, I think we have just over 40 people on the road on Sunday. Minimum the risks of punctures.
Is that similar to Paris-Roubaix? Are you taking the same sort of approach?
Yeah, the same approach, but like in this race we didn't want to take the risk that a team is doing two sections. So in Roubaix you can do four sections per team easy without speeding and taking any risk, but here we don't want to do this. So we have, I think, in total 15 teams. Some teams you can do the first and the last section, but like the middle sections, it's all different teams, so that's why we have so many people. And so the approach is similar, but we use a bit more people.
Well, I mean, you like the cobbles, obviously, but what do you think about this stage? Is it almost too tough for the Tour de France, too difficult, or are you in favour?
No, I don't think it's too difficult. And one of the reasons people or some riders think it's too much or too difficult is that most of them are not used to it. And maybe I say something stupid and not everyone agrees, but I think if the cobbles are in the Tour every year, it's less of a big thing than they're used to it. And they know, okay, we have the cobbles and we did it a few times now, and it's not like rocket science riding the cobbles. It's just have a little bit experience and confidence, and then anyone can do it.
So that was Service Canavan. We've got a couple more days to look forward to the cobbles, but that is a stage that will throw up the sort of drama that we saw today, we suspect.
It's not going to rain, is it? We know that. We're pretty confident it's not going to rain. It's going to be a dust bowl all day Sunday, I think.
Probably. But we should wrap things up for tonight. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. I can smell the... I think the chicken is spinning slightly
tonight,
quicker.
Tonight's been less surreal than last night, hasn't it? We've stuck more the cycle.
If anyone got through to the end of the third section of last night's podcast, I said in the car earlier today, it's like Sid Barrett-era Pink Floyd. You either get it or you don't.
Yeah, there was a mention of intravenous injections, and I don't know. I mean, we didn't.
Horses.
I can promise we didn't. We didn't have, as far as I know, any intravenous injections yesterday.
Thank you, Francois.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast at the 2018 Tour de France. Thanks to our sponsors, Tafa and Science in Sport. The music is by Santoré. This episode was produced by John Mooney.
When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat, and boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
A t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors. The difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Learn why at Schwabvious.com.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of U.S. soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.